The Tom Woods Show, episode 716.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, it's almost that time. Bob Murphy and I are hosting a cruise in October 2016. It's the Contra Cruise, named after our podcast Contra Krugman, and we've got a lot of terrific things lined up. How could this not be the best time you've ever had? Check it out at ContraCruise.com. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here. We're talking once again to Per Bieland, who has been a guest on the show in the past, but all the way back on episode 17. So it's been a little while. It's been almost 700 episodes since we've had Per back on. But he has a brand new book released just yesterday called The Seen, The Unseen, and The Unrealized: How Regulations Affect Our Everyday Lives. That's, of course, going to be linked to at tomwoods.com/716. Per is Assistant Professor of Entrepreneurship and the Records Johnston Professor of Free Enterprise at the School of Entrepreneurship at Oklahoma State University. You can follow him on Twitter at Per Bieland, and that's P-E-R-B-Y-L-U-N-D, or check out his website at perbieland.com. Per, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again, Tom. It's good to be back.
Let's talk about regulation. A lot of times people think that the problem with libertarians in particular is that they don't believe in regulation. And what kind of a blockhead would you have to be? What kind of a numbskull would you have to be not to recognize the merits of regulation? Now, in your book, you're not looking at a particular kind of regulation or empirical examples of regulation. You're looking at regulation as an economic phenomenon and tracing out its various consequences. So you are really taking this on at the most fundamental level. So let me take you outside your book a little bit and just start off by saying, is it correct to say that libertarians don't believe? And by the way, I know you've written a book on economics, not on libertarianism, but you know, I have a libertarian audience, and let's talk about that. Is it correct to say libertarians don't believe in any form of regulation? Is that how you would put it?
No, it's not. We would believe in any kind of regulation that is market-based, that is voluntary, such as standardizations in technology and so forth. If it's regulation in the sense of when the government does it, that is prohibition or simply outlawing certain actions, making trade impossible because you will put people in jail or things like that, then of course we're not pro such regulations in any form.
All right. So it's not that we oppose all forms of regulation. It's there's something about government regulation as opposed to some professional association certifying the quality of some product. There's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. But why is there nothing wrong with that? What is it particularly about government regulation that should arouse our skepticism?
Well, I contrast it in the book with destruction. And the point with doing that is part of playing off of Frédéric Bastiat's well-known essay on the seen and the unseen, where, just to recap very quickly, where a boy destroys a window. And people say, oh my goodness, that's horrible, you destroyed the window. And then someone says, well, wait a minute, that means that the glazier gets more business, so he can invest that money in doing something else and so forth. So there's actually a good economic effect of destroying the window. That is what is seen. Of course, the unseen is what would have happened otherwise, that the owner of that building would probably have bought a pair of shoes or something like that. With government stepping in and regulating a business, what they're really saying is that certain sets of actions or certain types of actions are never, ever okay to do. Destruction sets us back a little bit in terms of value. We lose value, but it also means that we change our preferences. So in the case that Bastiat talks about, for instance, where with the window, the owner of the house changes his preferences. I mean, he's made worse off, of course, because he has to buy a window. But it's also the case that suddenly he values getting a new window higher than the other things that he could have done with the money otherwise. With regulation, we don't really change our preferences. The preferences are exactly the same, but we cannot take certain actions to satisfy those preferences, which means there is a mismatch suddenly between what people want to do, what people would value doing, and what they can do. And it's not like that it's costly, which is a problem that the market sort of deals with and overcomes, at least more and more the more we produce. But it's something we cannot do, and it's prohibited based off of violence. So it's not really a cost. And there's also not a temporary setback. It's not something we can get around, really, in the market, because it means dealing with violence, which is a non-market measure.
All right, let's try and walk through this. Maybe you can give us an example of how a particular regulation, following the way you think about it. I mean, just think of it this way. Most people hear regulation and they think this is a case of government wanting to make me safer, whether it's financial regulation, wanting to keep my money safer, or it's regulation of consumer product quality. It's to keep me either from being ripped off or from being physically harmed by a consumer product. Yes, government is taking some options away from me, but these are options no one in his right mind would want to exercise. So what's the problem?
Well, I mean, very, very often I would add, just for the sake of those in government, that they probably mean well in many cases as well. I mean, they want to save people from themselves and so forth. Whether we agree with it or not is another matter. But I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Well, the question is, given that you're saying that with regulation, people simply have their options taken away, and that's it. It's a destruction of their options. But most regulations people are familiar with are taking away options no one would want to exercise. My option to buy an exploding toaster, my option to put my money in an unsound bank. Why would I want those options? I'm glad those are regulated away.
Well, right. And those things would probably be taken care of by the market anyway, because you don't make money selling toasters that explode unless it's for a movie set or something like that. But the problem here is thinking about it as a one-shot game, as an economist would call it, talking about regulation as affecting only what regulation directly is aimed at affecting. And the point of the book that I've written now is to trace the real effects of regulation by not only looking at, as Bastiat does, the seen and the unseen in the first step, but actually going through sort of the Cantillon effects throughout the market process and look at how does this affect other choices that we make? How does this affect production that could be very far removed from what is directly affected by the regulation? And what are the effects then for people who seem to be not affected at all by this? And what I find is, I have an example at the very end of the book where I go through a little society talking about, okay, so this is, I trace out production and I walk through sort of value creation in this little market without any regulation. And then I go through the same example again, and I look at, okay, so what happens if there is just one minor regulation that is very specific and has only to do with one specific type of production? What happens to what everybody's doing, the value that is available in this marketplace, and so forth? And it turns out that in a very, very small example, everybody's affected in a negative way. Everybody's worse off. Several people have jobs that they would rather not have, and there's less specialization, which means simply that the whole market is set back, and constantly set back as well. So it's not like I mentioned before, destruction is something that we can work around, and that we can regain sort of the value that was produced and destroyed. But a regulation sets back the market basically forever.
I want to come back to that example, but let's talk about, you actually mentioned sweatshops in your book as a kind of example of what you're talking about. How do sweatshops fit into this?
Well, it fits into the whole contrast between the seen, the unseen, and the unrealized, which is the title of the book. And the unrealized is sort of my own addition to this. And in terms of the sweatshop, when we talk about the sweatshop, of course, you have the progressives who are outraged by the sweatshop, and they see how people are working in those sweatshops at terrible pay, and and they don't have any Western safety standards, and they don't have, as would be the case in, for instance, Sweden, my home country, they don't have 5 weeks of paid vacation and things like that. Instead, they're working really hard, probably six days a week and so forth. So it's terrible. Well, that's the scene. The unseen is what would have happened had they not been given this option, this job in the sweatshop. And of course, as libertarians, we use that argument quite a bit, and some conservatives do as well, that saying that, well, the sweatshop is better than the other options that they have, simply because it pays better, it is a better job, and people are actually lining up to get those jobs, because many times the alternative for them is prostitution or starving to death, and those are definitely not very attractive choices. Now, the unrealized is, what would have been had there not been regulation in this market? And that would be the options that would have been there had there not been regulation. And when I talk about this, I show that for a sweatshop, there's nothing technologically saying that you couldn't have this level of productivity and this level of production anywhere in the market, because the sweatshop is there, so it proves that it is feasible technologically speaking. It's not feasible economically unless you are the sweatshop, and the reason for that is that there is some form of regulation that is setting the market back, that is forcing out certain actors, that is keeping production and value creation down to a lower level, which creates these monopoly situations for those companies running the sweatshops, which means that what the real problem for these people in these poor countries is not that the sweatshop offers a job that is not as cushy as a university professor in the U.S., but that there are not more jobs just like that. Why aren't all jobs in these countries as good as the sweatshop? Or possibly better. And that's where regulation comes in. This, because of regulation on international trade and things like that, that affects who is actually producing in this country, where can these people get jobs and so forth.
Let me ask you if this is an illustration of what you're driving at in the book. Ben Powell gave a talk on sweatshops at the Mises University program this year, and one of the points he made involved some interviews that he did with people who actually work in sweatshops. He actually went to, I don't remember which, might have been Guatemala and possibly one other place. And he actually sat down and said, all right, suppose you could get the following amenities, but it would mean a slight decrease in your take-home pay. You know, you could have more pleasant working conditions. You could have the hours that you want. You could have more breaks. You could have whatever it is. And he had a whole long list of things. And overwhelmingly, I mean, very often 90%+ of the answers were no, we don't want that. At this state of the development of the country, they didn't quite put it this way, we would rather have the money. Right now, we just need the money. Yeah, it'd be nice to have the money and comfort, but right now, I'll take the money. And then later in my life, I'll see what my combination of desires is. But of course, we know that what regulation does all over the world is to deprive people of that choice, to be able to choose the combination of compensation forms that they might want. They want money, but they also want these other things. Well, maybe, but it turns out they really just want the money. But if government says, well, sorry, you have to also have this amenity, they're going to lose some of the money they want. They're actually going to be worse off than if they'd been allowed to make their own choice. So is that an illustration of what you're driving at?
Well, sort of, but that is the sort of direct effect. And what Ben is talking about is really the unseen. What are the options? I mean, would they choose to not have these? Would they choose to have something else instead of the pay if they had the trade-off, which is basically recognizing both the seen and the unseen? What I'm talking about is the market process as a whole, and yeah, these people really like their jobs in the sweatshop because they are a lot better than any other job that they could possibly get. But what would have been the case had we not regulated and basically stifled the market process in these countries and elsewhere in the world? What sort of options would they have had, and what alternatives had they been presented with in addition to the sweatshop? That is what is unrealized, and obviously you can't study that because those options are unrealized. And that's not really part of Ben's story. I think Ben is doing great work on that and showing exactly how Sweatshop actually benefit people in poor countries and how that is a way of letting these people and those countries catch up with the wealth that we have accumulated and created in the West. But I think another important point is to look at the unrealized and look at where could we have been without these regulations. I saw an article on lewrockwell.com many years ago. It was called something like the year 3500, or that's where we would be without the state. And that is sort of a summary of my book, because what I'm doing is looking at the market process. What sort of value, what sort of a prosperity is produced in the market? And what happens if you add a little regulation, just a little bit somewhere, just for someone's safety or someone's security, or making sure that people get a little vacation or that they get sick leave and don't get fired, or something that seems almost harmless and very beneficial for those who get this sort of benefit. But what happens to the market overall? And what sort of services do not get produced? What sort of products will not be offered? How does this affect the whole capital structure in the market? What sort of machines, what sort of knowledge is never produced because we have regulation in some area that seems very specific, that seems very limited, but still affects everybody's actions through ripple effects in the market, and thereby sets the whole market process back.
Let me ask you to do something that's quite difficult, actually, but I like putting the burden of the difficult tasks onto the guests squarely. You say that at the end of the book, you do have this example where you walk through a society, more or less laissez-faire society, and then you introduce a regulation, and then you walk through step by step what the ripple effects wind up being. Now, that may be hard to reproduce in its entirety, so we'll tell people that it is more involved than you're saying, but I wonder if you could still at least give it a try so that we have a clear understanding of what some of these effects that we might not be able to anticipate might actually be in practice, so that we can see the real life application of this.
Well, sure. The whole book is really full of these sort of hypothetical examples where I from the beginning create a little market with just a few people and look at what is trade and how do people benefit from trade and what happens if there is an additional guy added to the equation, and how does this little society evolve over time if we just have trade and people only produce for others their specialization? I mean, in a real market with specialization, we do not produce for ourselves. We produce in ways that we produce goods and services that basically serve other people's needs, which means we can specialize in something and become better. And that means that we can then benefit ourselves from the result of what we produce. So these examples are throughout the book, and the reader will follow the same population sort of in a small society. And the last example is going through sort of the evolution of this market where you have a few people, you have a couple of people who are nailsmiths, someone who is a construction worker, someone who is an apple grower and so forth. And I walk through this example and we can see that, well, there's suddenly an increase in demand for housing. So this construction worker gets a lot of more business, which means that someone else who is interested in construction work, but there is not really market demand, not, at least not sufficient for this lady to start building houses. So she waits and maybe she plans to start this type of business and she gains the competence and skills and so forth, but she's still working on her second best option, which is something completely different. But with this increased demand, she suddenly can take the step into building a house for payment. And that in itself means that in this little society, suddenly the number of businesses and the number of building projects underway doubles. which means that someone else who has sort of a crappy job can get into a specialization that didn't exist before, but that there is now market demand for. So he goes into producing planks, I believe, so that he can sell those to the construction workers, which means that they can focus on building the houses rather than cutting down trees and all this stuff. Then I introduce a regulation on the nailsmiths, saying basically a real example from the real world, from industrialization, saying that they need to have taller chimneys because of the soot and all this pollution and everything from their work. And this means that it raises the cost a little bit for the nailsmiths. It raises the prices a little bit for nails in this little market, but it also forces one of those people out of business. He needs to find some other job, which affects how many houses are demanded in the market, which means that this lady who's dreaming about becoming a construction worker and producing houses, she's not able to take that step because there is no market space for it. There's no market demand. And the same thing with this guy who wanted to specialize in producing planks. He can no longer do this because there's only one construction worker and only one house being built. So this construction worker, he produces the planks himself and cuts down the trees and so forth. So even though the regulation has really nothing at all to do with, say, house building and the art of house building, in this little example, and there's more to it, of course, suddenly this market does not have production on planks. Just because there is a regulation on the height of chimneys in the nails for nailsmiths, which is, it seems to not be very related. In this example, they're a little bit related because you can't have a market, I think this is like a dozen people, and they don't do related things. But in a very big market, say the global market today as it is, regulating something that seems to have nothing at all to do with you will still affect what choices you can make and what sort of jobs are available for you, what sort of specializations, what sort of goods and services can you buy. But I mean, and not just looking at sort of the purchasing power of your wage, but looking at what options are actually made available to you in the market. And that's the unrealized, what never comes to be really for us in our real lives because of some regulation somewhere.
All right. Now, that is a good description of these ripple effects. And I think another interesting point of that is that it means that a lot of people who've had their lives dramatically changed for the worse, particularly when it comes to choosing their occupation, will never be able to trace out the line of causation leading to their distress. They'll never trace it back to the regulation. Maybe they'll blame it on Chinese competition, or they'll blame it on the free market, or who knows what they'll blame it on. But they won't place the blame in the right place. Now, is that, by the way, part of your thinking about this as well, or are you? Because I mean, maybe you're just acting as a dispassionate economist who wants to teach some lessons. But to me, that's one of the principal lessons, is people won't blame the right source.
Well, I can't lie to you, Tom, of course. that's how I started thinking about this, about regulation, because when we study regulation, we look at the direct effects and maybe sort of the second-order effects. But how does that really affect us? Well, as libertarians or Austrians, we say, well, the whole market is affected somehow. And I was interested in seeing, okay, but how, really? And thinking about it, I realized that, wait a minute, it's not really only the case that we get a little poorer. Because anyone can say, well, I mean, if I don't get a raise of 5%, but only 4.5% next year, but people get education or whatever, then we could have a little more regulation, a little more taxation and whatnot. It doesn't matter so much. But it's not really, I mean, Menger taught that already in his magnum opus from the 1870s, that we don't talk about goods in the same way as neoclassicals talk about them, as a sort of infinitesimal little pieces. We talk about full goods, a whole egg, or if we want to make a pie, maybe we need 6 eggs. Well, that's the good we want to buy then. Well, that is the same thing when we have options presented to us in the marketplace, that it's not the case that they will, that heavy regulation will take away 12% of sort of the choices I can make. No, they take away a number of the goods and services that I would have been able to choose otherwise. So the effect is probably a lot greater, and it's not going to be the same for everybody, because we have different wants and needs. So some people are going to be a lot worse off, and some people are not going to be all that worse off, but they're going to be worse off anyway. So I wanted to look at sort of the real effects on each person and each individual in the sort of choice situation, because that's I think that is the powerful argument. It's the sort of almost emotional argument as well. And I think that is where the discussion should be. Talking about aggregates is not really the Austrian way. And talking about how say, the economy doesn't grow the 0.1% that otherwise would have been growing, that doesn't mean anything at all to anybody. So maybe that seems like a small sacrifice to make for the promise of some sort of regulation. But if we look at the unrealized, the options that would have been presented to us, or the options that would have been taken away had we had even more regulation, then it becomes a lot clearer to us and a lot more personal. And the question is, how much have we lost individually, and how much have our families lost because of these regulations? What exactly would have been available to us had there not been all this regulation?
All right, let me play devil's advocate on your example. A first devil's advocate argument would be, in the same way that there are losers from regulation, surely there are winners. If there aren't going to be as many houses built, well, then something else will be built. Labor and resources will go into another channel, and maybe there'll be more opportunities over there, and those people benefit. And since we can't assign cardinal utility to people, how can we say that my benefiting from the unintended consequences of the regulation isn't as important as your loss from the unintended consequences of the regulation? Wouldn't we just have to say, well, it's a wash?
Well, that's sort of where you would end up if you would only go with the Bastiat route, right? I mean, yeah, you lost a window pane, but look at all these ripple effects. It would basically have this Keynesian multiplier effect, right? So the multiplier effect, if we skip this, the problem with interpersonal utility comparisons for a little bit, and just talk about money values, well, you would have multiplier effect one way or the other. So, like you say, isn't it really not much of a difference anyway? But looking at the unrealized, you add this dimension to it, and I think the last example that I quickly summarized a minute ago actually shows this quite well, that the effect is not simply that some value is taken away from us, but that we miss out on a bunch of specialization in the market. And we know, since at least Adam Smith, that with specialization comes productivity increases, which means that we can create a lot more value using less resources, which means that we lose a lot of this growth that we would have had otherwise. So it's not a wash, and it's not simply losing a window pane, as in Bastiat's example. It's really losing all the potential that we would have gotten had there not been this regulation. And in terms of the window pane, I mean, that's a temporary setback. That's a minor distraction. It happens all the time. And yeah, we replaced the window pane. We would have wanted to do something else, but then we, of course, this guy adjusts his preferences, and then he chooses whatever he wants more when he does whatever purchasing or invests his labor or whatever it is. But with regulation, it's basically saying, well, you can never ever buy shoes, as this guy would have bought had the window pane not been broken. So if no one ever can buy shoes, how does that affect the market? Well, obviously that means that we will have a lot of problems. We will develop products which would never have been wanted at all before. So if we can't buy shoes, maybe we develop products for protecting our feet in ways that do not involve shoes. This is complete waste of resources. And people who would have specialized in shoemaking or any type of supplies needed to make shoes or sell shoes or transport shoes or whatever it is, they would have to stick with their old jobs and they would not specialize further, which means, of course, that the effect on the market process and its value creation is enormous. It is not the window pane. It is a lot, lot more.
All right. And one other thing. Let's take your air pollution example, the example of the chimneys. Now, that's a case, maybe not all examples are like this, but the one you chose is a case where even in a pure free market, something would have to be done about that pollution because it would be actionable. So there, maybe they would have to make taller chimneys. I mean, maybe in the free market, they wouldn't say to you, here's how you have to solve the pollution problem, but they would say you have to solve it. And that solving it does involve the use of resources, and that will have ripple effects just like a government regulation. So what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that you get to do what is actually valued in ways that are actually valued. This is part of the competition as discovery process, as Hayek talks about, that rather than have a regulation saying you cannot, there will be a market demand saying for those who can produce nails, in this case, in a better way or in a less polluting way. So producers will shift their production towards the best use. Well, that is the market process. That is how we produce value. And of course, value is not only products and services offered to us. It is anything we subjectively value. It could be clean air, it could be whatever. So, but it's easier to talk about it as physical goods. The regulation, of course, it just says that you cannot ever, and that's it. I mean, say there is some sort of destruction in this marketplace after producers have begun to shift away from sort of this simpler production of nails so that they're cleaning up their processes and so forth. Then there's a destruction. Well, maybe they would go back to producing nails in the old way just because the demand for nails is so much more important now that all these resources are destroyed. So it doesn't matter. Pollution is no longer as important as it was. Well, with regulation, you can't do that. You have to go through the political process and change the laws and then change the bureaucracies and so forth. So it's more of a regulation is forever in a sense that a market standard or market technologies are not. Because in the market, if something happens, you can always go back. But with regulation, you cannot.
All right, good. I like playing devil's advocate and I like your answers. And I hadn't fully anticipated either one, so I like that even more. So I'm going to direct people to tomwoods.com/716, which is where I have the Amazon link to your book, or they can go directly to Amazon and pick up The Seen, The Unseen, and The Unrealized, How Regulation Affects Our Everyday Lives. Best of luck with it, Per, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
All right. Before I tell you what's going on tomorrow, which is we've got a juicy one coming up tomorrow, this is a blog that is exactly how I would do a blog if I were starting it off at the very beginning myself. And this is another Tom Woods Show listener who has started a blog, and you get nice mention on the show plus a nice backlink on my site if you start your site through my special link. All the details at tomwoods.com/publicity, including all my free video tutorials to help you get started. Well, the blog is called 2076project.com. So 2076project.com. It's a libertarian site, of course, but in particular what I like about it is that it talks about current events. Yes, it talks about, has a post on parents, children, and the non-aggression principle, which is something I talked about on a previous episode with Julie Borowski, saying we should write more about that, so we got that there. But it also looks at important libertarian books and gives them quick reviews. It looks at websites or looks at particular podcasts, gives them reviews. It looks at memes and looks at the truth or falsity of these things. So it's got all kinds of things. It's a potpourri. That's exactly how I would do it. So it's posts about interesting libertarian issues, whether it's Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, the minimum wage, diversity, Senator Elizabeth Warren, but then also looking at important libertarian books like Defending the Undefendable by Walter Block and other important libertarian titles. All these sorts of things are in the posts over at 2076project.com. So I will link to that in case you forget about it at tomwoods.com/716 as the listener website mentioned. Remember that tomorrow, if you're listening to this as I release these, tomorrow, which is August 17th, 2016, there is a one-day flash sale over at Bluehost where they're giving away web hosting for just $2.95 a month, which is crazy. So you definitely want to lock in that pricing if you can and get all the details about how to do that, how to get all these goodies and at tomwoods.com/publicity. That's the first link you should look at, tomwoods.com/publicity, before you do anything else. All right, tomorrow we're talking about the Scandinavian welfare state, the so-called, and actually a little bit broader. We're looking at Nordic socialism, so-called, and the myth of the success of so-called Nordic socialism with the author of a brand new book called Debunking Utopia. So that has just come out this week, so it's going to be a lot of fun to talk about that. So you won't want to miss episode 717. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.